I want to welcome you to the 12th week of our verse-by-verse journey through the entirety of God's inspired Word. We are in Genesis chapter 38 today. We're going to start in verse number 6, where Judah is going to be focused on for a bit, despite the fact that we've got quite a few years we go over in this story. And then we're going to come right straight back to the story that we interrupted with Joseph being sold into slavery. So this is just one of those times that I have a hard time keeping all this in proper chronological relationship, because you have to tell this whole story in one sitting for it to make the most sense. So we know that Judah must have gotten married around the same time that Joseph was sold into slavery. Now, when I say around the same time, I actually think he was probably married a few years previous to that and had already started raising a family. That's my opinion. My suspicion is that he was married in his late teens, and the story that we looked at with Joseph takes place when Judah is in his early 20s. So Judah and his wife raise three boys that we are aware of. And when the first son gets old enough, and again, I suspect we're talking about in his late teens, they make arrangements for him to be married. So Genesis 38:6, Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn. Her name was Tamar, so she's a local girl. But Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of He Who Is, and He Who Is put him to death. We're going to find out that at least the first two sons of Judah are not good guys. They are wicked to the extreme, so much so that God feels it is necessary for him to intervene and execute them. Now, it might be that he's holding this family to a very strict standard, because it will be the line of the Messiah. And so he is going to be much more likely to intervene if it looks like it's veering badly off course. So Judah is going to invoke now the conditions of what is called leveret marriage. Leveret has to do with a brother-in-law. This rule, which was practiced in ancient Middle East anyway, was to protect the line of inheritance, to make sure that there is a clear designation for the descent of property, or in the case of Judah, the descent of the blessing of the firstborn, including that blessing of Abraham, where in his seed, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. We really zero in on that being about the Messiah. So the way that it worked was that if an heir, particularly an heir, died before having a son, then his wife would marry the next unmarried member of his family. Typically, it was a brother. Other times, it might be a cousin. So we read in verse number 8 that Judah said to Onan, who is the second son, "Go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother." So the first son born in this next marriage will be counted as the first son of the last marriage, and therefore the heir of the line. And Onan is quite aware that this first son is not going to be technically counted as his heir. He has to wait until his second son comes along for him to have his own inheritance line. Now, at this point, I need to warn you. I need to be relatively graphic in the next part of the story. And so if you've got little ones that you don't want to deal with such issues with, you need to distract them elsewhere or turn this off and save it for later. But I just need to give you fair warning. What we're about to do is PG-13 stuff. All right? So that should have given you enough time. Let's see what happened next. Verse number 9. But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. See, it would be counted as Ur's son. So whenever he went into his brother's wife, he would waste the semen on the ground so as to not give offspring to his brother. And you get the sense here that we're not talking about a one-time incident or a couple-of-time incident. This becomes his habit. And we don't know whether he simply went in and masturbated and refused to have any type of sexual contact with her, or more likely, in my mind, he practiced a form of birth control that was known to the ancients and which actually is still used by some people today. And that is to interrupt the sex act before the man climaxes. Now, it's not a very reliable method. It can result in pregnancy because there is still some bits of semen that can be expressed before the climax. But his intention in whatever he was doing was to effectively say, I am not raising the heir of my brother with this woman. I am not even going to give it the possibility of happening. And so he is a wicked man as well. And it's likely that this attitude is seen in other aspects of his life. So he is probably just as bad as his brother was. And so we have God intervene a second time in a lethal fashion. Verse 10, what he did was wicked in the sight of he who is, and he put him to death also. Now, Judah may or may not be aware that this is God executing his sons. But Moses, who is writing this story several hundred years later as a prophet, is certainly cognizant of that fact. And so he tells us so, that God did this. What Judah is thinking, though, is that Tamar is the problem. That she is the bad luck wife who is bringing death to his boys. And even though he has a third son, he is already thinking he does not want to do this levirate marriage thing a second time with his third son, because he might die too. Now, this third son is not quite old enough to be married anyway, so he might be in his early or mid-teens. And so Judah, in verse 11, said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up. For he feared that he would die like his brothers. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house. So she is still technically married into this family, or betrothed into this family, to Shelah. And she needs to continue acting like the widow of the two husbands she's had, which means she should not be having any type of intimate contact with other men. She is supposed to wait until Shelah is old enough. And in the meantime, she is going to be at her mom and dad's house. Verse 12. in the course of time, which tells us that a few years has passed. How many? We don't know, but it's enough that Shelah is old enough to get married. We know that later. And so in the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. So Judah loses his own wife and is grieving over her. It says, when Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shearers, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. So he finishes the customary time of mourning right around the same time that sheep shearing season starts. And it's a time of celebration. It is a time of community get-together. There's contests and eating and things of that nature. And so he is going to go engage in all of that. But he, in his heart, is probably still grieving over the loss of his wife. Now, keep in mind, they have three sons, at least, that they've raised together to adulthood. And if, as I suspect, they got married when they are in their teens, that means they've spent probably 20-some years together, which is more than likely putting them up very close to their early 40s. So they've had a good long time together, and so he is saddened by her loss. Now, back to the story of Tamar. Tamar was told, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. And she took off her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself up, and sat at the entrance of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. So she has a plan in mind. Now, it's not an appropriate plan. Let's make that very clear. But it is a plan of desperation. It says in the next line, for she saw that Shelah was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage. So she knows her father-in-law is not going to follow through with marrying her to the third son. And it is her right to have an heir of this family with that son. And so she comes up with a plan as to how she will get an heir. And she uses her knowledge of her father-in-law to accomplish this. She knows that he's grieving. She may also be aware of his perhaps past practice of using prostitutes. We don't know that for sure, but it's a possibility. So she takes off her widow's garments, puts on clothes that allow her to wrap her face with a veil and look like a prostitute. Now, an old-fashioned English word for prostitute is doxy. And interestingly enough, that is from the Greek language and the word that appears here in the Greek Old Testament for a glory woman. And same thing in Hebrew as well. Some of the English texts treat this as if it's a woman who is acting as the prostitute for a shrine of a pagan deity. I am not so sure that that's intended by the word glory. I think it might instead be related to dressing up fancy to advertise her position as a sex worker. And so she gets herself right next to the double pool area. That's what Enaim means. So that's some sort of watering area, and presents herself as a glory woman, as a doxy. Verse 15, when Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. And so he turned to her at the roadside and said, come, let me come into you. For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, what will you give me that you may come into me? So she's disguising not just her face, she must be disguising her voice as well. And he answered, I will send you a young goat from the flock. So he has nothing of transferable value on himself for whatever reason. He doesn't have any gold. He doesn't have any silver. Nothing like that. So she wants to know, if you want credit, what do you plan on giving me as collateral? Because he's saying, I'll pay you later for services now. Verse 18, he said, what pledge shall I give you? And she replied, your signet and your cord and your staff that's in your hand. So she wants something personal, something that can identify this came from Judah. Now, the signet that we've got in mind is a cylinder seal. It's on a cord around his neck, and it's a carved cylinder that when you need to seal a document or some other item with your own personal mark, you take the thing off your neck and you just simply use your palm and roll this cylinder across the wax, or not wax, but the clay. And it makes an image that is unique to you. It's like a signature card, or excuse me, a signature machine. Also, his staff that he carries would be personalized as well. Might even have his name on it. So she says, I want you to give me the two things that clearly identify you. And that way I'll know you'll come and pay me. And so he agrees. He gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. He probably assumes, I'm going to get these things back later today. No big deal. She, though, has had this thing all planned out. The women of the ancient world were very in tune with the rhythms of their bodies. They could identify the most likely day or two in their cycle where they could become pregnant. So she picks that particular frame of time. And she does. She gets pregnant. And so she doesn't need to hang around here anymore. She can now leave. Verse 19, so she arose, she went away, taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood. So she goes right back to the way she was. Verse 20, when Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite to take back the pledge from the woman's hand, he didn't find her. And he asked the men of the place, where's the cult prostitute? Now, this is where the English translators assume that there must be a shrine involved. I do not. It's just simply the word for glory. So where's the glory? Where's the doxy who was at Enaim at the roadside? And they said, there's no doxy that's been there. So they were not in the habit of seeing a doxy at this site. So they don't know what he's talking about. So he returned to Judah and said, I've not found her. Also, the men of the place says, there is no doxy that's been here. So Judah replied, well, just let her keep the things as her own, or we're going to be laughed at. You see, I sent the young goat and you didn't find her. So he feels like, I tried to do what was right, in a relative sense. I tried to pay her for services rendered. But she's not around, and I don't want to go wandering all over the area looking for a prostitute to pay, because that would be embarrassing. So he just simply forgets about it. Fast forward 3 months, verse 24. About 3 months later, Judah was told, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been immoral. She's been sexually loose. Moreover, she's pregnant by that immorality. And Judah said, bring her out, let her be burned. Now, the penalty of the Middle East, at least in this period of time and in some places, for a woman who betrayed her betrothal was burning alive, burning at the stake, if you will. And Judah who is not acting appropriately here, folks. We need to acknowledge that. He sees her pregnancy as the perfect opportunity to get rid of her. He's been dragging his feet. He doesn't want to marry his third son to her, even though that's the legal requirement by the culture and the time. And since he can now invoke the death penalty for cheating on Sheila, because that's effectively what she did, then he can be rid of her and then marry his third son off to whomever he pleases. So good luck, or bad luck, Tamar will be gone. But remember, she's already thought ahead. She was going to get pregnant, and she needed to prove who impregnated her. And maybe we should talk about that for a moment. She has effectively said in her mind, if I can't marry the third son, then I need to marry the next member of the family of my dead husband's. And Dad is available. He's not married. So that's why she targeted him. He is a potential fulfillment of the Levitical marriage law. So she's pregnant by him, and now she needs to prove that it's by him. So verse 25, as she was being brought out, that is to be executed, she sent word to her father-in-law, by the man to whom these belong, I'm pregnant. And she said, please, identify whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff. And Judah identified them and said, she is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah. So he comes clean and says, they're mine. And she's right. I was in the wrong not marrying her to Shelah. And now she has tagged me as the leveret marriage partner to fulfill the legal requirements of inheritance. And so he is technically her husband now. There might have even been a ceremony, I suppose, to make it all clear. But the verse finishes in verse 26, and he did not know her again. So he refuses to ever have a sexual encounter with her another time. She's pregnant with the heirs, heirs plural, because we're going to find out she's got twins. And so all of that has been satisfied, but he does not want to be in this ongoing sexual relationship with her. So she's going to raise their sons there in the home. And so she will move from her father's house, her father and mother's house, to Judah's house now. Verse 27, now we jump forward another 6 months. When the time of her labor came, there were twins in her womb. Now, they would have been able to feel around and know that. So they got prepared to identify who is the firstborn. You've got to be clear when you've got twins as to which baby comes out. First, because that's the line of the promise. That's the line of the heir. So when she was in labor, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. So it was her job to identify the firstborn. So she wraps that red cord around his wrist, ties it off. And now, once he comes out the rest of the way, they can lay him off to the side. And if an identical twin comes out second, then they've got no problem distinguishing which is which. But then something weird happens. He doesn't get fully born. Verse 29, as he drew back his hand, behold, his brother came out. So now the brother is the actual firstborn. He is the one that came out fully and completely. And so she said, what a breach you've made for yourself. And therefore his name was called Perez. Perez means to break forth, to break out. And so he gets his name because of the fact that he jumped ahead of his brother at the last moment and wins the race to be the firstborn. And then afterward, his brother came out with the scarlet thread on his hand. His name was called Zera. So Perez means breakout or breach, and Zera means rising. And it's kind of the idea of the rising of the sun, I suppose, in the sense that he was the first guy that showed himself because his hand came out and got marked with the little red thread. But he's going to be second born and not the heir. Now, this is important because later these two boys will be going off to Egypt with their dad once Joseph reveals himself and brings his family there. And so their names will come up again at that time, probably shortly after this story has finished. The other thing is that Perez becomes the royal line that produces King David and all of the other kings that came from him. But more importantly for our purposes, the Perez line is the line of the promise. In your seed, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. And so this is the line of HaMashiach. This is the line of the Messiah. This is the line of Yahushua HaMashiach, Jesus the Messiah. And when you go to the New Testament and you see Jesus' genealogy, you will see Perez's name. All right, so that finishes it up. When we come back tomorrow, we will go back in time to when the sons of Judah are young and when Joseph is 17 and a slave in Egypt.